when your modernist cooking book came out, one positive reviewer called it food porn, a characterization you don't necessarily mind. You wrote an entire essay about it in this new photography book.
Well, food porn is one of these funny topics where the meaning it has to people depends almost entirely on the context. It was first brought up in the 1960s as a negative term by a feminist who was equating all cooking to objectifying women or something. A lot of people these days take pictures of the food that they're eating and put it up on Instagram, or they look on Pinterest at various food pictures other people have done, and they call that food porn in a positive sense, meaning it's not your grandmother's food photography. It's something new and exciting and edgy and pushing the boundaries.
And who cares if you're objectifying a vegetable? I mean, the vegetable doesn't mind.
We already exploit food as food, right? I read one account that said that food pornography was about making food sort of salaciously exciting and appetizing.
You're okay with that.
I am fine with that, man. Food is to be eaten. And if you take food pictures that make you hungry, that's a good thing, at least to me.
Well, the photography in the original cookbooks was pretty amazing. But in this new book, The Photography of Modernist Cuisine, it kind of goes beyond that. It's a big format book. And as you flip through it, you would not automatically identify the things with food. If you took the cover off, you might look at it and think, what's going on here? Some abstract expressionism? Were you kind of shooting for a higher level of visual communication through this, rather kind of disconnected from food?
Well, we often take food for granted. We don't look at it in detail. And part of our mission in doing food photography, first for the cookbook and now for this new book, is to get people to look at food a different way. Now, sometimes that means a perspective you've never seen. So we have shots of things like lentils or rice that are super close-ups. You know, you'd need a magnifying glass or even a microscope to see it. But it's there in front of us, and so we overlook it. We have other pictures that of phenomena that happen in the blink of an eye. They're so fast, we don't focus on them. A fundamental part of all of our food photography is the idea that you just look at food in a different way. So, yeah, it wasn't so much we were trying to make it higher level or more abstract as to challenge the conventional thing that food photography is supposed to look like, this idealized plate.
Well, one of them is a gunshot through a bunch of eggs lined up, and it's like tiny little micro shots of it. So you see the process of the bullet as it goes through the eggs. That's you don't use that in your kitchen, do you?
Well, we had a chapter in the book on omelets, and there's this old expression: if you want to make an omelet, you got to break a few eggs. We'd also bought a very high speed camera, and the high-speed camera led to us putting a recipe in the cookbook for ballistics gelatin. Now, ballistics gelatin is the stuff you see on CSI or Mythbusters. It's this stuff that the police and the military use to mimic human flesh, which is kind of gross. But it quivers when you shoot it. So somebody said, hey, if we have a recipe for ballistics gelatin, let's shoot some ballistics gelatin. Well, pretty soon someone says, hey, let's shoot some eggs too. Mm-hmm. So we took the picture of it being shot, and it has no culinary purpose whatsoever. But it was fun to shoot, and I think it's kind of fun to look at. It's another way of seeing a food item in a context you've just never seen before. In this case, eggs being vaporized by something.
Many of the techniques that you describe in modernist cooking involve pretty expensive equipment, but there are some things that people could actually do at home. You talk about a superior method of wine decanting, which involves a common kitchen utensil.
Yeah, we call it hyper decanting. And the basic idea behind decanting is two things. First, there are dissolved gases in the wine that may give it an off taste. Sulfur dioxide is an example. If you agitate the wine, some of those gases can go out of solution. They can go out of the wine and improves the flavor. Another idea is to expose the wine to oxygen. So a typical wine decanter has a much larger inside than the outside, and the the wine steward or the person at home pours the wine so it forms a thin sheet over the inside. That exposes the wine to lots of air, allowing these two processes to occur. And I thought, hey, if that's good, why don't we turn up the volume a little bit? So we pour a bottle of wine into a blender, particularly a large blender like a Vitamix, but any blender will work. Depending on the size of your blender, you may not hold the whole bottle of wine. Then you put the cap on, hold it tight, or you're going to have a red ceiling. Mm-hmm. And then you put it on frappe, or whatever the fastest speed of the blender is, for 30 seconds.
And how will it taste different when you go through that method of decanting?
It changes the taste, and it changes it in pretty much the same way decanting does, but more so, it tends to take the harsh edges off a young wine. Now, I would typically do this with a red wine, and particularly a younger red wine that is going to be a little harsh and tannic. And in almost all of the blind taste testings that we've done, people prefer the wine that was blended to the wine that was decanted normally or was poured from the bottle.
Okay, this is one you can try at home as opposed to shooting the bullet through the eggs.
Well, there's two reasons to do it. One is, as I say, it improves the taste. The other thing is the looks on people's faces. Oh, my God. We have this idea that wine is this privileged, you know, ceremonial kind of thing. And when you pour wine into a blender at the table, your guests think you're joking. You turn it on and the shock is just because everyone's like, oh, yeah, I have to mollycoddle it and I have to treat it so specially. And there's this snootiness. What the hell? Blend it.
My guest is Nathan Myhrvold. Climate change is one of the topics you're very interested in, mm-hmm. and that you've been working on. And you recently co-wrote a paper called Global Warming is Both Faster and Slower Than Expected. How can that be?
Hmm. So, you know, global warming is a huge problem for the world. At two levels. At a political level, it's about the worst possible problem for the way we govern our planet because it's a long-term issue. And it's very hard for most governments to make a painful short-term trade-off for an uncertain long-term gain. By the way, that's the same reason I'm fat and most people in America, actually. More than half of us weigh too much. The short-term gain of having that extra donut or that extra serving is just more attractive to us than what we know is right in the long term. Mm-hmm. So it's very hard. But it's also hard from a scientific perspective because we don't know all of what's going to happen. And the best way to get at that is to run a set of computer models. And so there's more than 20 different complicated computer models that people have developed to try to understand all of what's going to happen as the planet starts getting warmer. Well, what Ken Caldera, my co-author, and I did is we analyzed the output of about 20 of those models and compared them to each other to understand what are the parts where our global understanding of, at a scientific level, is the same and what are the ones where they're different. And we found many interesting things. One is that as you increase CO2, at least half of the benefit, at least half of the problem occurs very quickly, within the first 10 years. So if you think of all of the harm that's going to happen from CO2, the first 10 years give you half of it. The second half takes about 100 years. So it's the reason we said it's both faster and slower is in the short run, in a 10-year time frame, there's actually more harm than people had originally thought. The remainder of the issue takes a long time. Now, that's actually very bad for us as a planet for this short-term, long-term phenomena that I described. Current course and speed, we may not do anything about climate change until the pain starts occurring. And then it'll keep happening for another 100 years. Mm. And that's a very bad situation. You know, if you look at problems, environmental problems the world has solved, things like Love Canal and the air over Los Angeles or other things, if you have a really severe problem like that, people complain. It eventually gets fixed. Yeah. Right now, Beijing has terrible air pollution. And eventually, the Chinese will get tired of that, and they will fix it. Because there's a short term right. between making a change and seeing a benefit.
I'm thinking of the frog in the pot of hot water that stays in the pot until it boils and kills the frog because it doesn't notice that the problem is there.
That is a great metaphor for this, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Instead of the frog, it's our whole planet that is on a slow boil. And the question is, when do we decide to jump? And if we do, will it be too late? Will we have already have baked in another 100 years of increase no matter what we do?
Well, Nathan Myhrvold, you've come up with a number of really interesting ideas around this, one having to do with what's called bioengineering. It's making some changes to try to not necessarily slow down the amount of global warming that's taking place, but figure out a way to kind of ameliorate it or mitigate it. And we spoke 4 years ago about a possible partial solution. It was called the Stratoshield, and it relied on a giant hose that would be lifted by helium balloons 15 miles into the atmosphere. And then this hose would pump sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere, thereby cooling the planet and maybe counteracting greenhouse gases. What's been going on with that idea over the last 4 years? Has it moved ahead?
We presented it to the world as kind of a thought experiment. This whole field of geoengineering is one that is very nascent. And 4 years ago, it was considered very radical and kind of crazy. We still thought it should be part of the debate because we weren't doing anything. Now, if I look 4 years later, we're still not doing anything. Okay? So the CO2 concentration has risen every year for the last 4 years. In current course and speed, there is no programs or agendas in place that's going to cause that to change. Now, one approach is to say, hey, we all conserve and we get rid of the SUVs and we all convert to clean energy. And there's a variety of problems with that. There are economic problems with that. There's technical problems with that. But set all that aside, we're just not doing it. Okay, just flat out, it hasn't happened enough to actually affect CO2 production. So where people are making those effects, they're moving to renewable energy. For every person that's doing that, there's another half dozen of them in China that's polluting more. So net-net, the world's in a worse place now than 4 years ago. As a result, this geoengineering idea is attracting more scientific scrutiny. You know, we were never going to build this system. We've done some more calculations on it. A variety of other people have also calculated different, and they've proposed other geoengineering schemes. I think it's the kind of research that we have to do because we're not doing anything else. You know, if plan A isn't working, you ought to think about a plan B.
After we aired your interview on this idea of the Stratoshield, this geoengineering idea, we got a very annoyed phone call from Tom Ackerman, a professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of Washington. And he said this idea would do nothing about his major concern with global warming, which was ocean acidification. He said this is not going to help the issue that I'm really concerned about.
Well, okay, first of all, the guy who first discovered and popularized the concept of ocean acidification is in fact Ken Caldera, my co-author on this last paper and several previous papers. So we are totally plugged in with ocean acidification. The fact is, he's right that thing doesn't fix ocean acidification. It's not perfect. Now, I've got two ways to explain that. The first is to say, hey, it's the best idea I had so far. If you can come up with a better one that fixes ocean acidification, great. The second thing is, if you actually look at it technically, ocean acidification is on a slower time scale than the thermal problems. So as the temperature rises, there's a lot of concern that we get across tipping points. And if we get across those tipping points, that something very catastrophic and sudden will happen with the climate. And many of these have been proposed. An example is permafrost melting in the Arctic, or methane clathrates. That's a funny kind of ice at the bottom of the sea that holds a lot of methane gas. If that gets a little bit warmer, then you could have catastrophic release of methane from there, or a dozen other tipping points. There's also a lot of absolute potential harm. I say potential because current science doesn't let us track back and say, oh, this storm was due to global warming and this one wasn't, or this drought was due to global warming and this one wasn't. But Everything that we've seen suggests that there is a very clear and present danger to humans up here on the surface of the Earth that says we ought to do something about temperature. I'd love to also do something about the ocean. And the new news I have there is it's not impossible that you could do geoengineering schemes to affect ocean acidification, and we've done a little bit of thinking about that. And we don't have a perfect solution there, but I think that it is potentially feasible. There are other people working on geoengineering schemes that take CO2 out of the atmosphere that also would help relieve ocean acidification. So, but even the biggest Ken, who has worked tremendously in ocean acidification and others, will tell you that the tipping points would be different than for the climate and would be potentially further out there. So we may well have a century to solve ocean acidification, whereas we may have considerably less time to deal with temperature. And the reason I say may, let me be really clear, is we're in an unexplored part of parameter space, as you say technically. We don't know what's going to happen as the temperature increases. The most optimistic of the temperature models make it seem like it's not that bad. Okay, so they're predicting by the year 2100 a sea level rise of 8 to 12 inches. Well, that's very similar to the sea level rise that occurred over the last 100 years for other reasons. So could the world survive a 12-inch sea level rise? Yes, it could. And it would be a bummer for Venice, Italy, because it's barely above water to begin with. And it'd be a bummer in lots of ways, but that's probably not catastrophic. But there are models that predict feet, many feet of sea level rise. There are models that predict the Gulf Stream shuts down and the entire climate of Europe changes. In fact, maybe of the whole globe changes. Those kinds of dramatic scenarios are possible, but no one knows if they're going to happen. But it's the possibility that they would happen that, to me, drives the need for understanding geoengineering.
Nathan Myhrvold, another area where you've applied your thoughts is the area of malaria transmission. Actually, a lot of people in Seattle are working on that. But you take a look at how to get rid of the mosquitoes that caused this to happen in the first place. Intellectual Ventures, I understand, is developing a device that would zap the mosquitoes with a laser beam. And this sounds really interesting. It sounds a little crazy. Well, I mean, mosquitoes are spread over such a large area. Wouldn't you need a whole bunch of these laser devices to zap them? How would it actually work?
So we have many programs about trying to eliminate malaria. And there is one set of them which is focused on the mosquito, because the mosquito is one of the weak links. We have others that are programs focused on modeling malaria so we can understand how to cure it in humans. So the first thing is you don't need to kill all the mosquitoes. First of all, you only need to kill the females because it's only the females that bite. Mosquitoes actually live on nectar of flowers. Most people don't know that. That's all the males eat. The females mostly eat that, but there isn't enough protein in the nectar for them to make eggs. So the reason that a female mosquito bites a person or anybody else to get a blood meal is because they need the blood protein to make their eggs. So the other thing is you only have to protect people. You don't have to kill all the mosquitoes out there. You just want to kill the ones that are about to bite somebody or that have already bitten someone and are about to transfer malaria to somebody else. So we came up with a bunch of ideas. Nets are one example, bed nets, so you sleep under a bed net. It's done quite a bit in Africa. It's made a difference. It isn't enough. There's a whole bunch of reasons it isn't enough. Well, you can spray like crazy with DDT. That works great, at least for a while, till they get immune to it. But then there's environmental impacts of using DDT or other insecticides. So we came up with a bunch of crazy ideas, and one is to literally spot the mosquitoes in the air and shoot them out of the sky with lasers, which is just as crazy as it sounds. It actually works. It's very satisfying when you see it happen.
And it can spot the female mosquitoes?
You actually can tell the difference. We can tell the difference the same way they can tell the difference. It's important to know who's a male and who's a female if you're, in the dating kind of a mood. And if you're a little bug, you really don't want to fly over and say, oh, damn it, that wasn't who I was looking for. So the female is a different size and has a different wing beat frequency. So we can, in fact, by measuring the wing beat frequency, which we can do from 100 yards away or more, we can tell if it's a male or a female.
Nathan Myhrvold is my guest. You run a patent company. You made your reputation at Microsoft. How do you respond to those who might say, Nathan Myhrvold, you're a knowledgeable person in certain areas, but who are you to opine on climate change? You're not a climatologist. Who are you to weigh in on things like biological terrorism attacks, which you've also written a paper on? You're not a terrorism expert. What do you bring to the table that maybe specialists do not bring?
Well, anytime you have a problem that confronts society, you need to work at it at multiple levels. You need to work at it at a very scientific level, and each of these problems has a very scientific and technical component. I can do some work there. I've published, this is my third paper that's been published in peer review major journals, so I'm kind of a climate scientist. Admittedly, a junior one and a limited one, but hey, I can kind of do that. But you know, that isn't the only way we solve problems as a society. We also have to take those ideas and take them to the world at large. We have to have it be part of a public debate. We have to have it affect the governance of how we run our country and our planet. And many people are involved in that. People that have a lot lower qualifications than I have in anything. So I decided that rather than only channeling my energy to purely technical or purely business things, I have some ability to understand technical stuff. I have some ability to understand how the world works. That if there was an opportunity for me to lend my voice in a unique way, maybe it was worth doing. So consider it my quixotic pro bono attempt to try to help the planet in at least the ways that I think would be helpful to get these things as part of the public debate. You know, geoengineering was actually first proposed in the most rudimentary way in the 1960s. A variety of people considered it in the 1990s. There was a National Academy study. But it was a topic that I felt had much less attention than it deserved. So we both did some work to invent a couple crazy schemes that were maybe a little more practical than other ones. And then I tried to call attention to it, including by talking to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that putting those things as part of a broad public debate is a good thing for the world. You know, recently, I published a paper on bioterrorism. After 9/11, like everyone, I wondered what could I do. And I volunteered for a variety of advisory boards, and I tried to think of, you know, what could my contribution be. And one of the things that occurred to me during that period is there are currently thousands of American servicemen manning radar stations in submarines deep below the ocean, in missile silos and bomber bases, and they're all waiting for the Soviets to attack us with missiles. Well, there aren't any Soviets anymore. Russia is very unlikely to launch a nuclear attack. We still have all these people there. Why? Well, partially because we haven't gotten around to spending money on that.
Well,
but
plus, as you point out, there are a lot of people out there with ways and means to conduct bioterrorism.
Exactly. So what is the most likely? Is there anything that could be catastrophic, like a missile attack? And the answer is bioterrorism could be. Lots of people who know more about it than me have done scenarios that say a bioterror attack could kill between 100,000 and 1 million Americans. And because the world's such a connected place, if you had an attack that killed that many Americans, you're going to kill a lot of people in other countries. You know, if an attack hits New York City, there are flights leaving New York City for every capital in the globe every day, or just about. So a release of smallpox, or maybe something even worse, could kill millions of people. And I think that that is a problem that we are not putting enough attention on.
Aside from not putting enough attention on it, do you have any ideas on where that attention could be placed in an effective way? Because one of the attractions of bioterrorism for a small group is that it's relatively easy to do and disseminate, and there are so many vulnerable targets.
Well, there's a lot of – there's groups that have already done it.
Yeah.
Okay? There was a non-lethal but still very effective bioterror attack by the Rajneesh group in Oregon, I think in the 1970s. There was a Japanese terror
in the
group,
subways.
Shinrikyo.
Yeah.
They released sarin nerve gas in the subways and a train station, but they also made biological weapons, and they're also working on a nuke, by the way.
Mm.
There have been – the anthrax attacks in the U.S. Senate are believed to be the work of a lone perpetrator who is a U.S. bioweapons expert who made the stuff apparently – and attacked it apparently. I say apparently because he committed suicide before anyone could really get any definitive answers out of it. So we've had three attacks in the developed world in just the last 30 years. If somebody wanted to do this, what would we do? Well, I think if we put our brains to it, we could come up with both effective policy solutions, effective coordination solutions, and effective research agendas. You know, as an example, we don't have very much in the way of combating unknown diseases. We put lots of effort into known diseases, but suppose there is an unknown virus. This occurred in real life when the SARS virus occurred. Now, that wasn't bioterrorism. That was a natural virus, but it suddenly burst on the scene. It's going to happen again. There are natural viruses that live in other animals around the world that will rarely but occasionally get transferred to people. Well, the SARS virus killed a bunch of folks. Ironically, it jumped from southern China to Toronto, where it shut down every hospital in Toronto. Because well-meaning people, when people got sick from one hospital, what'd they do? They took them to the next hospital without realizing it was so incredibly contagious.
Mm.
A research agenda focused on novel antivirals, broad-spectrum antiviral drugs, would be a great thing for an unknown epidemic. And that's something that maybe you'd use it in a bioterror context. Maybe it's for a natural pandemic. Something like that's going to happen to us.
Nathan Myhrvold is my guest. We've been talking about a lot of the projects of your company, Intellectual Ventures. The company also purchases patents, and there's been a great deal of criticism of that. People say this activity holds back innovation. But you've said this notion that the patent system is broken is completely wrong. You've said people who make the case that the patent system is wrong are making argument by anecdote. So I'd like to pose the opposite of that to you. What, in your view, proves that the patent system is working?
Well, the patent system has been with us since the very beginning of the country. George Washington and Thomas Jefferson both signed the first U.S. patent. George asked Tom to look at it, and he said, yeah, it was good, so they went with it. It's working because that is what inspires the biotech industry. That's what inspires a tremendous number of industries whose business model wouldn't be possible if they couldn't get a patent protection on a drug or a therapy or some compound. Their investors literally wouldn't give them the money to do it because those companies are very unlikely to be able to go all the way through FDA approval and manufacture the drug and make money if everyone could just copy it. Even in the technology industry, the patent system works. Most major technology companies file for patents. Most of them have occasion to use patents from time to time. The idea that the patent system is broken is a bunch of self-serving anecdotes. For example, if the patent system was broken, then wouldn't you think that you discover large disparities in the number of patents that were thrown out after reexamination? There isn't. Wouldn't you, if there was lots of bogus non-substantial lawsuits being brought, well, then you'd say, well, the statistics of the lawsuit must mean that those guys lose most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
They don't. Any statistic that you look at from a objective perspective of looking at large numbers tells you a different story.
Well, as you'll probably acknowledge, though, some people disagree with you about the patent system working.
They do.
Including President Obama and including members of Congress who are in the process of drafting up some changes in the patent law. I'm sure you've taken a look at some of those proposals. What do you think of them?
Well, I'm not sure in the process is the right thing to say this week.
Not this week, no.
They're busy bankrupting
yes.
the United States
yes, also,
this week.
They're also busy not doing immigration reform and a number of other things, but
well,
it's in the mix somewhere.
Yeah. So One of the most interesting sort of civics lessons I've had is watching how Washington really works and doesn't work. So there are a bunch of proposals in Washington. Some of them are driven from a very partisan perspective politically. In this case, it's not partisan politics, though. Patents aren't about partisan in that sense. They're partisans in a commercial sense. There's companies that depend on patents, and they want to improve the system in one set of ways. And we'd be one of those companies, and we think there's room for improvement. It's not perfect, but you also don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Then there's a set of companies whose business method or their business model is basically to take other people's intellectual property and use it, and they don't want to pay for it. And those guys have very partisan proposals that they put out, and they put out through sympathetic members of Congress to try to weaken the patent system. And then what happens over a period of time is people debate and they debate and they debate, and eventually the tug of war comes to something that's probably more reasonable. And as ugly as some aspects of our system of government can be, and this week is a good example of the dysfunction in Washington, we found that in the last round of patent reform, which resulted in the America's Invents Act, which President Obama signed into law, which we supported, it came to a relatively reasonable place. There's parts in that law that people can argue with. There's parts that that are widely viewed as being positive. There's parts that nobody knows yet. The patent office is in the middle of, and the courts in the middle of actually implementing that law. It's awfully premature to be changing, but the way Washington works, the people who have their axe to grind are out grinding their axes. So I think what we'll see is a set of proposals, some of which we are going to support, and I think would really be a benefit. Others are pretty out there. And they're things that are designed to either address an issue that is a very partisan issue to one industry or to one subset of a few companies, or they're trying to weaken the patent system overall.
Give me an example of something that you should think is way out there in a negative way that's on the table right now.
Well, of course, it's very unclear to say what's on the table at any one point in time. There's multiple drafts of different bills. You know, at one point, there was a provision called loser pays. And the idea was if you file a patent lawsuit and it's a frivolous lawsuit, that not only should you pay your own court costs, you should pay the court costs of the other guy.
Not a good idea?
I think it's a great idea if it's symmetric. Okay? Because if a patent holder brings a frivolous lawsuit, yeah, the hell with them. Those guys should pay. On the other hand, if a company goes and deliberately infringes and deliberately takes somebody else's intellectual property, they should pay. Why wouldn't you make that symmetric? Well, the first versions of those proposals were very unsymmetric. Mm-hmm. We support a symmetric loser pays. Now, there's other people who have a philosophical point of view that loser pays isn't a good idea. Fundamentally, that isn't an issue for us as a company because we don't make frivolous lawsuits.
Nathan Myhrvold, have you applied your notable analytical skills to taking a look at an initiative that's on the ballot here in Washington State this fall that would require the labeling of genetically engineered foods? There's a massive public relations battle going on right now. It's one of the most heavily funded anti-campaigns in the state's history. The pro side would require genetically engineered food to have a label on it. What do you think about that measure?
So I think you have to wind up saying, well, what's genetically engineered and what isn't? And why are we turning up our nose at some things and not others? All farming is based on selective breeding. It's a primitive kind of genetic engineering. You try to make hybrids, and then if the hybrid does better, then that's the version that you want to use. And the hybrid occurs from finding different strains and crossing them and crossbreeding them and carefully taking advantage of that. It's genetic engineering. It's a different kind of genetic engineering than if you do it in a very technical sense by cutting snippets of DNA out and putting it back in. But between those two extremes, there's a whole spectrum of different points. genetically engineered foods have been in our food, depending on which version of this you want to call genetically engineered. You know, many of those strains come from mutations, and those mutations come from cosmic rays. So I could say deadly radiation modified the genome of organisms. Woo! Well, it did, but that's what produced the albino version of the pure white corn, or corn with the super sweet gene, or a whole variety of other things that are very valuable. It'd be silly to take those out. Now, when it gets all the way to the technical modifications where you insert genes, people have studied that, and they've studied the health consequences of that. There's no objective reason for anyone to not want it. So I don't see what the point of this is other than a funny kind of scaremongering. Mm. And I'd use an example, which is the way that the organic label has been completely debased. We have a section of this in our cookbook. You know, originally, the idea behind organic was to say, let's do something which is got a traditional base and usually was higher quality. It was often local. It was picked when it was ripe, not when it was green and hard, like the way most tomatoes are picked, and so on and so forth. Well, when it was just a few people at Pike Place Market 30 years ago and a few other farmers markets, very few farmers markets then, it was one thing. But these days, organic has been legislated. Then it's been loopholized. U.S. Department of Agriculture first made an organic standard, they had a list of about a dozen chemicals that were still okay to put in food. Well, it turns out in the intervening time, that dozen, which were supposed to be sunset in a short period of time.
And you think the same thing would happen if the genetic engineering measure were to pass because of this confusion?
I think that when people try to pick a simple proxy for something, there's lots of unintended consequences. So as a result, there are organic vegetables being created by the ton in the United States, created and sold, that aren't really any better for you. They aren't any different. They often use more noxious chemicals because all of the loopholes have been carefully examined, and then lobbyists have gone and changed all of it. So what started off as, oh, organic means it's good, it's totally debased. And it's a way to overcharge us for stuff that isn't any better.
A couple final questions. Wealthy Americans have a larger and larger share of the wealth in this country. And this concerns some wealthy people like Bill Gates Sr., who is pushing for an income tax on high income earners, and also an entrepreneur who's supporting a $15 an hour minimum wage, Nick Hanauer. Is this an issue in society that concerns you?
Well, one of the things that I love about America that I think most Americans would say is a great feature is the idea of a relatively classless society with enormous mobility. And mobility actually happens in both directions. You can be rich and lose it all, and that's okay. And you can be poor, and if you work hard and you're smart and you get and you're lucky, or maybe if you're beautiful and you sing well on American Idol, you can become enormously successful.
And that's exactly the critique, is that we're not as mobile as we were, that we're sort of stratifying into rich and poor, and there's not that mobility. Do you buy that?
It's very unclear to me that that's true broadly. It may be true in some areas, and to the degree it's true, I'm against it. When you look at the people who've gotten rich in technology, you know, Bill Gates came from a well-off but not a wealthy family. He's Bill Gates the third, the rich one I used to work for. Bill Gates the first and Bill Gates the second were not wealthy men. They did okay, but they were not wealthy men. I don't think Mark Zuckerberg came from a famous list of Zuckerbergs that have owned large chunks of land and controlled America. The technology revolution has been about upward mobility. Now, you could make an argument that would say that the limitation of technology as an upwardly mobile thing is that it's about smart nerds, and given that I'm a nerd, I don't view that as so bad. That's my people rising up, finally. If you took a 1950s a Mad Men stereotype, the people who got ahead and got rich weren't nerds. They were people who were well-connected, and they were WASPs, and they had this whole other set of criteria. The technology world has changed that. It's not perfect because our educational system is failing so many kids at the grade school level that they don't have the opportunity to become the next Mark Zuckerberg or the next Bill Gates. So I have concerns that our system isn't upwardly mobile enough. I have concerns about the competitiveness of America in the world. You know, as the jobs migrate to places like China, because the Chinese are upgrading their society, we're not upgrading ours. And the part that is really the worst of it for me are the kids who are born into a situation where because of the educational disadvantage that they're at, it's almost impossible to catch up later.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Bill Gates Sr.'s idea was, well, let's tax the wealthy more and put that money into schools. Nick Hanauer's idea is just give people without a lot of money a little bit more with a $15 an hour minimum wage. What do you think of those approaches to this problem that you acknowledge is a problem when it comes to education?
So one of the unfortunate things about economics as a science is that it isn't much of one. And I have great – I have many friends who are economists, and they'll be emailing me afterwards. If economics was more as scientific as I would like to see it be, then you could get a room full of economists to say, yes, that proposal will work, or no, that proposal won't work. As it stands, economics tends to have a lot of ideology. So can you make – poor people richer by giving them money. Okay, that's a little bit, that's a very simplified version of this Nick Hanauer thing. It's not clear, economists argue. Will taxing the rich and putting it to education, will that be spent effectively? Is our problem in education the way simply the amount of money, or is it how we're spending it? I am not an expert enough on education to say exactly what the problem is, except the damn thing seems like a mess to me. It's, yes, funding is probably one of the issues, but there are well-funded school districts that fail. Now, there's also poorly funded ones, so I'm not saying it's 100% one cause. But again, education, there's enough ideology that's part of the system that if you got 10 experts on education – you'd get more than 10 opinions as to what's wrong. Hmm. And they'd be contradictory. This adage, it's very mathematical and nerdy, but the sum of random vectors is zero. If you get tugged in all these random places, you go nowhere. Hmm. And unfortunately, we have a problem in this country that there are a bunch of problems where we're stuck like that. And the budget debate in Washington, D.C. is clearly an example where we're stuck in a very bad place. But education is too. You know, the sad thing about it is, as heartbreaking as it is to see so many Americans that get failed, we fail as a society. We fail them by not giving them good education in the K through 12 period. It's still not broken enough that we have the willpower to actually fix it. So you have these giant debates, you know, should it be charter schools? Should it be this? Is the teachers' union a helpful force? Are they holding things back? You know, why should school boards in different parts of the country decide if evolution should be taught or not? Why on earth is that a good idea? All of these ancient political legacies have given us a system that I got to say, I don't know how to fix, but it's not clear that just pouring more money on would help. But I do think we should fix it.